So I wanted to start on our third section of Shmuel's Rise, and I just wanted to really thank you all for making it out tonight. This is the thick of things, and so Yashar Kachachen to everybody who is here, Asher Yeshna Po, Asher Nenu Po Yimono Hayom, for everybody who's being part of this as we step towards Rosh Hashanah. So I'm thinking we're going to move away from Shir next week because it's going to be after fast days. It's a little complicated. But if you have any afterthoughts, please let's chat after Shir about if you have any if you think that it's a good idea, a bad idea. What I'd like to do is the following: is we're going to do today. So just to see what we've done up till now, we did Perek Beis. We talked about the sons of Eli. We tried to understand their sins from various perspectives. We did a deeper sort of retrospective on their role historically and the bigger picture of that. Now we're going to do the same kind of thing. We're going to do Perek Gimel today, and then we're going to move on and sort of Perek Gimel Dalet, and then we're going to zoom out and try to consider this. Before we start this Perek, I'd like to ask maybe an unfair question. And the unfair question is that as we read this Perek, if you were the one who were writing Tanakh, would you have included this Perek? Thank you, Danny. Why would you include this Perek? What does this Perek add to what we know up till now? Okay, so with that kind of question, we're sort of questioning the need of this, which therefore ultimately makes us appreciate what we're really doing. Okay, so let's see why in a moment, why this Perek may seem a little bit unnecessary. So there's 21 psukim in this Perek, in Perek Gimel, and the way we're going to do is we're going to group it into sections, okay, as we usually do. We're going to group into three or four sections to sort of consider each segment of the story as a story. So we're told the following. Remember, Eli's just got this terrible curse from the Ish Elohim, the man of God, and he says, your children, they're not going to live long, they're going to die on one day, and it's going to be basically lost your state of priesthood, essentially. So now we're told the following. The topic of today is Shmuel becomes a prophet, because up till now Shmuel has not had a communion with God. Now is the first time we have it. So it says Vahanar Shmuel Mishareis Es Hashem Lifnei Eli. So this young lad Shmuel would serve in front of God, God in front of Eli. Udvar Hashem Hayo Yakar Be'ayamim Ahen En Chazon Nifratz. And we're told historically. So we're in the actual psukim over here in Perek Gimel. This is page 3. We know that we're told the historic note. That at this point in time, there weren't so many people who are communing with the divine. There weren't so many people that Hashem thought worthy of conversation. So, Ein Chazon Nifratz, they weren't just breakouts of visions. Okay, this is the sort of a statement of the times. It wasn't that day. So Eli is now is sleeping and he's lying down in his place. And he can't see. He's not able to see. V'ner Elokim terem yichbe, before the light of God would be annulled or extinguished, Shmuel shochei beichal Hashem asher sham Aaron Elokim. And Shmuel was sleeping in the heichal of God where the Aaron is. Okay, so this is sort of sets the scene for what's about to happen. So as you can see, there's a pay there, which indicates this is the end of the paragraph. So let's think about this for just a moment. What I did is I included just a few questions to consider. I put the questions as sort of headings. Tell me if you like the way we're doing it in the sources today. The first thing is that we know that Eli is old, okay? Because if we reverse back to Perek Beis, we're told that Eli is old, and that's when he kind of tried to reprimand his children, right? In Pasuk Chav Beis or Perek Beis, which is on page 1, we are told that Eli is Zaken Ma'od. So we know he's elderly. Why are we being told about the state of his vision? At this point in time, is that a necessary detail to understanding the context of what's about to happen? Or is it maybe more than that?
Well, maybe it's related to say that he personally couldn't have any further
nebuah. Okay, good. Excellent.
Because it's like a double thing. He's always dimmed and he couldn't see. They could have just said he couldn't see anymore.
Good. So maybe this seeing over here isn't necessarily physical, a physical sight. Maybe the double emphasis over here is talking about we'll call it in the inner eye. And how do you know that's true? What was the introduction to this perek was? We said that there wasn't nevuah, and how did it describe it? Ein chazon nifratz. What does chazon mean? Chazon means literally a vision. Okay, so the way it describes prophecy is the way is using the word of vision. So you say there was no vision at a time, and Eli's eyes are dimming. So to speak, we get the sense that, you know, the people who should have, could have, would have, are no longer perhaps available for that conversation. That linkage, see, the linkage of eyesight seems to be connected to that. I think that's exactly what the Radak does mean. Because the Radak, when they're trying to attack this, Rav David Kemchi, suggests first that it is the following. So there's, he actually adds a few levels of this. So he says, I'm starting to show on the third line of the Radak over here, and he says, "Der al derech pshutai, eloi matzasi loy ta'am nachon." I can't really explain. If it's just talking about his regular eyesight, there's no reason to tell us about his numbers right now, you know, physically. However, ve'im hu derech mashal, but if it's really metaphoric, then ve'rotzel omar. And what does it really mean to say? Einei halev. It's his inner eyes, the eyes of his heart. His, we'll call it his sixth sense. Okay, kolamar ruach hakodesh, the divine inspiration. V'tamo, and what does it mean? Shoyso ruach hakodesh oleches uposekes vimenu, shaloyso regila etzlo kevatchila. The ruach hakodesh is, so to speak, you know, now intermittent. It's like the signals breaking up for Eli. Yinei ma'ase bonav, because of his action, the actions of his children. So this is not a description of age, this is a description of regression, as says the Radak. Lefichach ba hanevuah azois el Shmuel v'loi ba elav. Says, therefore, says the Radak, that's why Shmuel is going to be the recipient of nevuah, not Eli. This is setting the scene for the whole perek. Uvidrash amru, now he sort of deepens it in Tanakh. Because before we get to this Radak, where else have we heard about a person who had weak eyes? So we're told, in fact, in almost the same terms, that there was a person called Yitzchak who had weak eyes, which introduces the whole blessing, the whole struggle for power, so to speak, of the blessing that went to either Esav or Yaakov. Introducing that was chaos. Why did he have weak eyes? Why did he have weak eyes? So there's a numerous explanations offered in Rashi and the Mefarshim. One of the explanations is connecting it to the Akedah, the angels crying, but there was another explanation. That explanation was that Esav married, the immediately preceding section of the Torah tells us that Esav married Bosmas, Bas Nevayos, right? He married these daughters who are Moras Ruach. They really, it wasn't a good shirach for the in-laws in the Yitzhak and Rivka house. And in fact, so Rashi says that what they would do is that when they would burn their incense offerings to their pagan deities, that affected his eyesight. Okay, so his lowered eyesight was as a result of what? Of his son's path of life, so to speak, right? Isn't that interesting that over here, what the Radak brings this parallel at the end of the Radak is, here you have another person, the Tanakh emphasizes their lack of eyesight, and that's because, again, of their children. Which comes back to a little bit of an issue that we discussed last week, which is, you know, it's we have to think about the blame shifting over here, like where the blame lies. You know, we're seeing a lot of weight on Eli, even though it's his children, right? But there's a lot of weight on the parents over here in this particular situation. So this kind of lays our groundwork. Now, you'll notice that not only are we told about an unnecessary detail, which is his eyesight, and we understand in a better context, but we're also told about the scene over here. So it's kind of like, what time of day would you place this, that the scene is? Like if you were to sort of have to peg this on the clock.
Night
time, right? So, but it seems late at night, earlier night,
twilight.
Okay, what makes us say that? Right, so the lamp is burning. So one would imagine this is maybe earlier now. But that's interesting because, you know, like we don't really need to know particularly it was 8:33 in the evening. You know, it really isn't, you know, a significant detail for us to know. You know, so, you know, like, you know, it's nice to know the sort of the surroundings. It gives us a, you know, a visual perspective of, you know, what the Mishkan's looking at this time, like at this time. But, you know, really, that's not really, shouldn't be a significant detail. Unless it maybe is. You know, what the Mefarshim debate is over here is, what light could this have been? Right, so we know that every night, every morning and every night, there was the menorah was lit. And when the menorah was lit, all the candles were lit, but the candle which was lit first which is called the Ner Ma'aravi, the Western candle. Actually, interestingly enough, most opinions hold that it wasn't the one facing the west, it was the second candle, the one who was westwards from the eastmost candle, just out of interest. Most people have a picture of the one facing the Aron HaKodesh. It actually isn't. It's the second one from the entrance, usually understood. That was called the Ner Ma'aravi. That candle, even though lit first, would burn all night. So maybe the description is that it could have even been late at night and the candle's still burning. Okay, very fascinating. Again, the question is relevance, significance. This isn't really helping us unless it really is telling us something else. Again, the Radak jumps in for us and he says the following. This is a very, very powerful symbol that he suggests is being described to us. We're going to start in the Radak in source 2, and he says in the embolded area, Uvidrash Omar. Once again, he evokes not the pshat, but he evokes the medrash, which says Ki al ner hanavu osai Omar. Once again, if we're going to go into the vision metaphor, what allows vision is light. Right, when we see things, it's essentially light waves which are entering into our eye, and they're reflecting off or being emitted by objects around us, and we're able to see them. So he's saying maybe the ner is about, or the light is about his prophecy, the ability of him to be able to see. V'amru v'zorach haShemesh u'bo haShemesh, and we know that there is this idea that as the sun is setting, there's always continuous light. What does that mean? Ad shelo yashkia hakadosh baruch hu shimshol shel tzadik echad hu mazriach shimshol shel tzadik acher. That when Hashem sets one leader of a generation, already the next leader is actually starting to rise. Okay, so as the sun is setting, the moon rises. And he gives an example. Ad shelo yashkia shimshol shel Moshe mazriach shimshol shel Yoshua. So that, therefore, when Moshe Rabbeinu was sort of ebbing down into his twilight, that's when Yeshua was rising as a leader. And similarly with Eli. So what's been described that the candle's still burning? It means that Eli is still at the end of his tenure now. And as the candle starts to wane, as the light starts to dim, understand that Hanar Shua Shmuel Hayom Sharis is Hashem. And that light starts now being kindled. So metaphorically, the perek is now setting for us a framework of transition. Okay, therefore is a very necessary detail to sort of allow us to understand what's about to happen. Okay, if we're going to look in this, and again, all the metaphors over here are light, sight, and that seems to be the way of describing their prophetic nature at this particular point. Okay. By the way, just as a quick aside, this is just very fascinating. When it comes to this idea of setting and rising, I believe there was a person who was I think what happened was they came to Rabbi Akiva Eiger, and the story was that his wife was at home in a very elongated labor, and it was very difficult, and he ran to Rabbi Akiva Eiger to ask him to pray for her that it should be smooth and that it should just finally end. And he said, I'm sorry, I can't. I can pray that the baby will be healthy, but I can't pray that the labor should be sped up. So he ran back, and of course he was there. The baby's born, mazel tov, and everything like that. The bris, he said, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, why was it that you didn't pray for this child to be born earlier? You could have saved my wife a lot of hours of pain. And so Rabbi Akiva Eiger said, well, I had a notion that this child is a very special child that your wife's bearing, and I know that, in fact, that because there's this we'll call it parity of leadership in the world, at the moment he would be born, I know there was somebody else. And in fact, I don't remember the names in the story because he identified who the person was who was waning at that point in time. If I were to cut earlier, then what we'd essentially be doing is I'm bringing new life in, but I don't want to be the one to extinguish other life earlier. He had a sense of that, and there was a particular person that he identified. I don't remember who it was. Where, he says, I'll tell you where I know this from. He says, when it came to, this is really just an interesting aside, is when it comes to Avram and, what happens is that it says that Yitzchak and Rivka are praying for children, okay? So they pray. And then they have Esav and Yaakov. It says, Vayaser lo Hashem. Hashem listened to Yitzchak's praying, his digging, his tunneling, so to speak. So the Midrash is an interesting thing. The Midrash says that if you do the timeline, you just have to look at the Pesukim, without even getting to Medrash. If you look at the Pesukim, you'll know that Avraham Avinu dies at the age of 175. Okay? And whereas Yitzhak delivered to 180. So the Midrash suggests that the mean, the default of the Avos should have been 180, like Yitzhak. And Avraham Avinu lost those 5 years. Why? Because as Rashi explains, that what happens is that when Esav and Yaakov grew up, Esav went out Latar Busra, in his teenagerhood, he went out he went off the derech. You know, there wasn't a derech yet, but there was, you know, the way of finding God, right? So what Hashem did was Hashem took Avraham to spare him the seeing his grandson go in such a way. So that's why Avraham Avinu's data is 175. So therefore, he says that when Yitzhak and Rivka were praying this whole time, essentially, the more they had to pray, the more they were cutting out of the life of Avraham, essentially. Meaning, God had this system in motion, and the more you pray, the more Hashem knows this child's going to, there's going to be something wrong. He's going to have to spare Avraham. So there's this balance at stake in this prayer. And by Yosef, he says, if I'm not mistaken, I think this is how this was said. I'm trying to remember who says this. I think Rabbi Akiva says this. Is Vayasela is the gematria of Vayasela. I think is the gematria of 175. I'm trying to work out I haven't done this for a while. Meaning to say that it was the amount of years. No, it's the gematria of Chamesh Shanim, of 5 years. Meaning when Hashem is listening to the prayer of Yitzhak, he is listening to the prayer of Yitzhak at the cost of Avram's life. So we have to just be careful in terms of this. It's interesting. Yeah, this is not the cost of life, but this is in terms of the rising and setting. Just interesting to consider the sort of the bigger picture rather than just the micro parts that we usually consider. Anyway, so let's go to the next section. Now with the scene is set, the psukim tell us the following. Let's go through the next paragraph exactly what happens. So we're going to read from Gimel to Yud in one set. So the psukim tell us, Vayikra Hashem el Shmuel vayomer hineni. So Hashem calls out to Shmuel, and he says, "Here I am." Vayaratz al Eli vayomer hineni ki karasa li vayomer loy karasi shuv shchav vayelech vayishkav. So he jumps out of bed, and he runs to Eli, and he says, "Eli, did you call me?" He says, no, I didn't call you. You can go back to sleep." So then it happens again. Vayosef Hashem kroya di Shmuel vayakom of Shmuel vayelech el Eli vayomer hineni ki karasa li vayomer loy karasi bni shuv shchav. Again, he has his voice calling Shmuel, and he jumps out of bed, runs to Eli, and says, "Eli, is this you?" And he says, "No, it's not me. Go back to bed." Ushmuel terem liyodayas Hashem. Shmuel didn't know how to relate to God yet. But terem yigale elav tevar Hashem. Hashem had never explicitly interacted with him yet. Vayosef Hashem kara Shmuel bashlishis. Umayokam vayelech el Eli vayomer hineni ki karas ali. The third time he jumps up and goes to Eli and says, "You called me." Vayoven Eli, and then Eli understood ki Hashem kare lanar. Then he realized that in fact this wasn't a bad dream. This was Hashem reaching out to this young boy. Vayomer Eli lishmuel, lech shecha vayom yikra elecha. He says, "Look, go lie down, and if you hear this apparition, this voice again, vamarto daber Hashem ki shome abdecha. You say, 'I'm listening, O God, I'm your servant is listening.'" Vayelech shmuel vayishka bimkama. He went to his place. Vayavolo Hashem vayisyatzev. Hashem came, and so to speak, his presence was standing. Vayikra kafam b'fam Shmuel, Shmuel, and he calls to him twice with his name Shmuel, Shmuel. Vayomer Shmuel, daber ki shame avdecha, and Shmuel now answers and sort of engages in the conversation. So there's a number of like strange things about this setup over here. Is interestingly enough, why did Shmuel? I mean, why would Shmuel run to Eli? If you try to think about this, why is he running to Shmuel? First of all, what does that show us about Shmuel and his relationship with Eli? We think about that. Right, so we have this sort of sense of fatherhood, right? It's almost like, you know, and this is really important to the general story, is that you know, remember that Eli is the person whose children didn't go in his way. But here you have the person who's, so to speak, so close as a son that the automatic voice is going to be the fatherly voice of Eli. It's like the surrogate son who's taking the place of his children in this experience. In fact, we know when describing how Nevuah works, Nevuah isn't that, you know, suddenly somebody goes to, you know, red, you know, phone box, you know, and picks up the phone, and God, you know, and, you know, press one to hear God. What happens is that you it's a lifetime of preparation. The way the Derech Hashem, the Ramchal describes it, sort of elaborating on how the Rambam describes it, is that a person has to spend a life of pure character refinement. Because you see, a lot of the times, what the barrier between us and God is ourselves. So we need to spend a lot of time refining characteristics to the degree that we're a very pure and in control human being, not just a person who acts on impulse, whether it be physical impulse, emotional impulse, psychological impulse, a person who's in full control. And as a person refines himself and becomes more of a spiritual person, and they spend time thinking and studying and contemplating and meditating, then maybe, after years and years and years, God will decide to interact with that person. Right? So Shmuel may have been spending a life doing all this, but he'd never had the experience beforehand. So he had no frame of reference to know what this meant. Right? It wasn't there was a red phone that he picked up. This was his first experience where all that character work suddenly paid off. But it was such a shock to him. Now, when thinking about this, it is a little bit strange because, you know, think of the situation over here. Eli is from what tribe? What is his role? He's a Kohen. He's a priest. Shmuel is a Levi. Now, generally speaking, the Kohanim would have more inner access than the Levi, and they would all be guarding. They would sleep around the Mishkan and the Beis Hamikdash later on to guard it. But we can imagine that Eli was probably more proximate to where the Mishkan was, and Shmuel's probably on an outer perimeter on a different side, which is very strange then, because you know why is Eli not hearing this voice? Let's ask the question differently. Where's the voice emanating from? So is this sort of God, zoning in from the sky and, you know, pinpointing a person that he interacts from? Where's the voice emanate from? Well, look at how the psukim line it up. You see, what we did is we actually stopped in the middle of the paragraph, but that sort of misled us a little bit. Because take a look at the way that pasuk hey, 1 second. Let's look at the way the psukim gimel to dalet work. You see, in v'ner elokim term yechbe shmuel shachev echal hashem asher sham aron elokim. We're told that he is sleeping in the place of tent of meeting where the aron is. Vayikra hashem al shmuel vayomer hineni. So what the mepharshim say is like, maybe there's actually is a run-on lines here. Maybe the paragraph is actually a misguiding detail in this respect. Because where was God calling out from? He was calling from, meaning his antenna was, the Mishkan Hashem. Now, which sort of sets up an interesting notion that God's voice can travel, you know, in a certain direction and skip certain individuals or stop at a certain places and continue at other places. And we've seen this before, actually. But when describing the beginning of Sefer Vayikra, we know it says, Vayikra Hashem el Moshe, me'oy el Moed le'mo. That's the first pasuk in Vayikra. Hashem called out from the tent of the meeting. And Rashi's a little bit puzzled by the fact that, you know, if God was calling from the tent of meeting, like this kind of similar model, where there's the antenna where Hashem is speaking through, which is the Mishkan, so why is it that nobody else is hearing? It should be Vayikra Hashem el, whoever heard it, right? Hashem, sure, his voice is emanating, and whoever was, you know, the people, the next door neighbors certainly heard it. And the people who are eavesdropping were hearing it, but no, apparently it was only Moshe. So Rashi over there actually says that in the beginning of Parshas Vayikra, that's the way it works. God can, in fact, the voice will emanate, but it has parameters. It isn't limited to wavelength and the substances traveling through and the air vibrating in the same way that regular sounds are. So Rashi says actually in the beginning of Vayikra, in source 5, he says, "Me'oil mo'ed melamed." That Hashem's voice would stop at the edges, the parameters of the Mishkan, when it came to regular interaction. Maybe you think, oh, you know what it is? It's just God knew exactly the right decibel rate to stop it at the edge. You know, the sound sort of petered off. He says, no, that's not true, because Talmud Lomar, the voice of God is very powerful. So it wasn't that it was a timid voice. So Rashi says that it was a very powerful voice of God, but that powerful voice only emanated in the areas that he wanted it to emanate to. So in a similar way, Rashi over here in Sefer Shmuel says a similar thing. Eli may have been closer, but ultimately Hashem's voice channels through to the places it needs to go in the oil moed. Okay, which sort of sets up it's a very awkward kind of setting then, because not only is Eli sort of waning, but he's being missed, he's being skipped over. You know, just the picture we're getting over here is you know, he understands, he knows where the voice of Hashem comes from, and he knows that he was in between it and Shmuel, but he's not hearing it, right? So you can, you know, just to put yourselves in Eli's, when Eli understood, the full import of what he understood was, he understood that usually when he heard coming from that direction, the voice of God, he wasn't, but Shmuel was. Okay, so that's part of what's unfortunately going on in his mind, just to give us a little more of an emotional sort of foothold in this. So that is fine. Now the question, just one or two other just basic questions to think about over here is why would Hashem set it up in this way? Meaning, you know, this is a little bit misleading, don't you think? You know, Hashem could have just sort of started the conversation. He could have just said, Shmuel, listen, this is God. I want to explain something to you about it, and then continue from there. But what does he do? He says, you know, Shmuel, silence. And Shmuel, like, jumps up and rattles out of bed. Shmuel jumps out of bed. You know, like, isn't that a little bit misleading? You know, it's you know, poor Shmuel, you know, he must be terrified. So it seems the Mefarshim tried to debate this, and one of the earlier Mefarshim, his name is Mari Kara, not Rav Yosef Kara, but the Mari Kra, who's one of the Mefarshim, Abshat says, as quoted in the Malbim, says that it was set up in such a way because Hashem wanted Eli to know that this was going on. Because if Hashem had just said, you know, Shmuel, listen, I got something to tell you. So then what would happen is Shmuel would have essentially been the only recipient of this nevuah, and no one else would have had to know. So Hashem set it up in such a way that Eli knows that something's going on, but he doesn't know what that something is. Not only there's not only just a transition of power, but it's a known transition of power that's going on. And Hashem wants him to know this. We can see why in a moment, because Eli's going to demand from Shmuel what was said. And it's going to pertain to Eli, which is sort of Hashem, it's Hashem's way of overflowing that nevuah for a collateral experience. That's what seems to be going on over here in the setup. I just want to ask you just a very simple question, and that is, what was Eli's advice to Shmuel? Meaning, when he realized this was prophecy, what was his advice to Shmuel? What should you do? Go down and say what? Let's just think carefully. Right? So if you're called again, then the words you should say is, speak, because your servant is listening. Did Shmuel listen to him? So look very carefully. He uses identical language, but he omits one word. When Eli recommends to him what to do, he says in Pasuk, Tess, he says, "V'amarta daber Hashem ki shomea avdecha." When Shmuel responds to this voice, he says, "Daber ki shomea avdecha." What is Shmuel leaving out? God. Why would Shmuel leave out God? Sounds like Shmuel, even though he's being told by Eli that this is God, he's not 100% sure. And by the way, you know, lahavdil, $1,500. But you know, when you go to Hamlet, you know, and Hamlet experiences the vision of his father, and there's this ghost that appears in the turrets of the ramparts of the castle. Was that a good voice? Meaning, was that a voice that improved the state of affairs in Denmark? And the answer is no. A lot of times Shakespeare does this, where there's a prophecy and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of demise. Macbeth, right? So you remember that Shmuel over here is being, Lahabdil, I'm coming back over here, is Shmuel is being very careful over here, because sometimes when you have disembodied voices and you haven't heard them beforehand, you have to be very careful what's happening. You know, wake up the next morning and now you're going to change your life. You have to be very careful. So Shmuel still is doubtful. He's never experienced this beforehand. He just says, whatever the being is, speak. Now it's going to be clear to him afterwards that it's Hashem speaking. But just even though his teacher has told him this, it sounds like Shmuel still has that seed of a doubt over here. Now, what does he actually say? So now we've got to the introduction. What does Hashem say to Shmuel? We're told the following. Let's read it all in one chunk. It's Yud Aleph to Yud Ches. This is the speech that he receives. He says, "Vayomer Hashem el Shmuel, hinei anochi oseh davar b'Yisrael asher kol shamoi titzlenu shtei oznav." I'm about to do something in Israel that anybody who will hear it, their ears will tingle in fear, in terror. There's going to be a terrible thing that's about to happen in Israel. Bayomahu, on that day, Alkimis Eli Ves Kolashe Dibatias El Beso Hachel Vachale, on that day that this terrible thing happens, then a calamity is going to, this my curse to Eli is going to take effect. V'igadati loy, and I'm going to tell him, Ki Shofet Ani Yesubu Abesoy Adolam, I'm going to judge his house for eternity. Ba'avona Sheyoda, in the sin which he knows, Ki Mekalilil Nohem Bonov V'loy Kiha Bohem, because his sons are cursing and he didn't reprimand them, he didn't dim them. V'lochen Nishbati Leveis Eli, I'm swearing to the house of Eli, Mishaper Avon Beis Eli B'Zevach V'Mincha Adolam, I'm swearing that there's no way they can go back. There is no regression now from the place that they're at. Vayishkav Shmuel ad haboker, and Shmuel slept till the morning. Vayivtach yestal sois beis Hashem. He opened up the doors in the morning. Ushmuel yorei me'agidus amara el Eli, and he's terrified to tell the vision to Eli. You can imagine why, right? Vayikra Eli el Shmuel. Vayomer Shmuel beni. Vayomer hineni. He says Shmuel. What is he? What's his appellation? My son. You think of the endearment over here. He says, "Yes, I'm here." Vayomer ma davar asher diber elecha. What is the matter that it was spoken to you? I'll not achached mimenu. Don't deceive me. Ka yaaseh lecha elokim ka yosef. So should I do Hashem do to you? In tachached mimenu davar. If you hide anything, mikol davar asher diber elecha that you received. Vayager lo shmos kol advarim ha'ele. Lekiched mimenu. You didn't deny anything. Vayomer. Hashem hu hatov be'inov yaseh. Hashem hu, it is God. Hatov be'inov yaseh. God will do what's best in His eyes. And this is the episode that we have over here. Very sad episode. So let's come back to this and think about this for a moment. There's a lot of things to think about. Just on the practical level, it sounds like this vision to him is saying very much the same thing, which is kind of like, I mean, we've heard this all, right? We've heard basically that everything is about to happen. What is being added on to what the vision that Shmuel is getting at night, to what the vision of the man of God had said beforehand? Okay, remember, the man of God had really said a lot of terrible things are going to befall the house of Eli, and now Shmuel's sort of getting the reiteration of that same promise. So what's going on over here? What's being added to our equation? Okay, so yes, you're right. So you're right. The clause about no retraction is being added to Shmuel, meaning that Hashem is making a shvua when God takes an oath. That's it. That's it. There's no way Eli can ever get out of this. So the emphasis is definitely added over here. Anything else? Anything else that's being added to our prophecy? He tried, but it wasn't successful. It wasn't sufficient.
I think it's a note just to say that it's an unusual word when he says "v'lo ki haba."
Yes, that is true, especially his eyes. Correct. Right. Very, very good. Very good point. That when he "v'lo ki haba," that he sort of didn't damper them. It's the same word used to talk about his eyes dimming, which relates back to the reason why his eyes were dimming, why he was losing his prophetic vision. Okay. But also, what is interesting over here is that maybe we conflated this. The two issues over here is there's another event which is being described as Shmuel. This is not just what's going on over here with Eli. Do you notice that? Meaning we're talking about a disaster which is about to befall the family of Eli. But we're also being told that it's going to occur when, what's the time frame of this event? When something else happens. What's the other thing? There's going to be a day where there's news which everybody's ears are going to tingle on. So there's something else going on. There's something else really terrible that's about to happen. Okay? And that when that terrible thing happens, says God to Shmuel, then this terrible thing's going to happen as well. What other terrible thing could happen? When is the only other places in Tanakh that we talk about news which is so bad that ears tingle in tremor? It was only discussed when it talks about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Which means to say that what's the news which Shmuel is getting is not just about Eli. What's the news about? The destruction of the Mishkan. Okay, the Mishkan has been there in the desert. The Mishkan's been there in Shiloh. It's been there for over 300 years. It's been their place of worship. It says, God, there's news coming, and this news is going to be so terrible. On the day you receive that news, then the curse of Eli is going to take effect. So Shmuel's not being told specifically about Eli. Shmuel's being told about something much bigger. And that means to say that Shmuel now is not hearing just what the Ish Elohim said specifically to Eli. He's being told about the state of affairs in all of Israel. Okay, now Shmuel, that takes on a much bigger scope than what was just going on beforehand. If you want to understand what's really happening over here. With that's a bit of a bigger detail. This is sort of like the role of leadership. You can see Shmuel's being initiated for leadership because now his responsibility is what's happening outside, not just in the family. Just one or two brief points in conclusion is it says an interesting thing. How did Eli convince Shmuel, the poor Shmuel, the next morning who woke up and was sort of trying to mind his own business and open up the curtains and not meet Eli? You know, so how did he convince him to tell him what happened? He threatened him. What was the threat? He says, "Koyal yaselacha, Hashem should do such to you." What's the such? Okay, it could be a regular lashon shua, meaning it says, you know the unknown, you know that sort of I don't need to say what's going to happen to people who do, you know, who cross my path, kind of thing. It could be that, but it could be also what the Maharishim says. Well, what's the only other bad thing which Eli has and has had in his life is what's the thing that has befallen Eli is his sons didn't follow in his path. So he says, maybe suggested this. I'm trying to who suggested this. And the Malbim says that, you know, The Rashi says that ka'osa klala atzmo shlo yelacha bonim hagunim. Meaning he's saying, if you're not going to listen to me and just let me in and take me out of my suffering, knowing that you had nevuah and I didn't have nevuah and I don't know what it is and it was only given to you, then, you know, you should have the same fate. Now, interestingly enough, let me ask you a question. Did Shmuel have the same fate? Not to the same degree, but Shmuel did have the same fate. Shmuel's sons did not walk in his ways, as we're going to see in the beginning of Perek Ches. It says when Shmuel grew older, his sons weren't going in his ways. Very similar to Eli, which, by the way, sets up an interesting dynamic in Shmuel itself, where there's parents and biological children and parents and surrogate children. And the surrogate children usually seem to be the ones who become the real children, like Shmuel's becoming the Bani of Eli, right? Which seems to be the pattern that's being set up over here. So that's what's interesting is, but wait a second, Shmuel told him. That's not fair, right? Isn't that fair? It's a curse. So the Gemara Makos says something, and this is something I think just very practical in life, and that is that, you know, in general, the curses of very righteous people, have import even if perhaps the conditions aren't met. So an example is by Yehuda. Yehuda says, if I don't bring back Binyamin, v'chatasi la'avi kol hayamim, I'm going to sin to my father all days. All day sounds like two dimensions of world, maybe this world, maybe the next world, but basically it's a very, very bad thing, okay? And the Midrashim pick up on that. They say that it's based on the verse in with the blessing of Yehuda v'zosli Yodav Amar, that it sounds like that Yehuda was in some form of limbo. Even after his death, he wasn't able to access the next world. Why? Because his words, he said something very, very strong. Another example, Yaakov Avinu says, whoever has the idols will die. Next parasha, Rachel dies. She had the idols. He didn't know that. He wouldn't have meant that if he really knew. But nonetheless, words need to be carefully said. Curses aren't empty. So even though, you know, he said this is a very big thing. The stakes were too high that he put on Shmuel telling him. And in a certain diluted sense, it did actually occur. The same cycle occurred to Shmuel, which is like a little bit of a tragedy which occurs over here. Not clear. Rashi does do a timeline of Shmuel's life, but I don't remember what the time that he says that the nevuah happens. It would be very interesting to kind of figure out where that is. We know there's two when he enters the premises. I'm not sure at what point this is over here. He is called a Nar. Remember, Binyamin is also called a Nar when Binyamin was many decades old, but it means, you're right, it means a younger, you know, so I don't think it means necessarily only a teenager or a youth. Let's conclude one or two other thoughts over here. Let's finish the last three psukim. It says, in your test to Chavalev, it says, Vayigdal Shmuel v'Hashem haya imoy v'lo yipilni kol dvarav arza. Shmuel grows up and Hashem was with him. Hashem never threw from his mouth any of his words down to the ground. That's a very interesting phrase that appears elsewhere in Tanakh in a very interesting context. I'm going to put that on just the backbone as to where else this appears in Tanakh, that throwing to the ground. But it sounds like, what do you think that means? What do you think the pshat of the psukim is trying to tell us?
That he heeded everything that he said.
So it's more than that. Well, it's not only did everything he said, but that everything he said was did. Meaning, everything that he said came to be. Now, generally with Nevi'im, that might be true, but the Mevarshim is saying that might have been even in his colloquialism, meaning even the way he talked, we're going to see, and we should, by the way, track this. Shmuel HaNavi never makes a mistake. He never gives a nevuah which doesn't come to be. There's only one mistake we can really track in Shmuel's intuition. We're going to see where that is. There's only one mistake, not in what he said, but in what he thought. But otherwise than that, Shmuel was one of the most powerful Nevi'im, Bar David, right? Which is very interesting why that happened. But Shmuel HaNavi is given this prime spot in Nevi'im. Everything he said came to be. God, so to speak, was bound, so, or chose to bound himself to the words of Shmuel. In fact, Vayeda kol Yisrael midan ad Beersheva, ki neman Shmuel Navi Hashem. The word spread that he is a faithful prophet, and Vayosef Hashem leharaos b'shiloi, ki nigla Hashem al Shmuel b'shiloi b'dvar Hashem, and Hashem continued to emanate from Shiloi. Notice the word over here is leharao, to be seen. Because remember, coming back to the beginning of the parak, the whole thing Isaiah was there's no chazon, there's no vision. Now the vision is returning to Shmuel. In fact, the way the Malbim describes this is most beautiful. He says that Shmuel, so to speak, became an antenna for prophecy. Where Shmuel went, the people around him were able to access God. That's how powerful, you know, he was a very, you know, never mind 4G. You know what I'm saying? Like, he was the place wherever he went, then people had this divine inspiration. That's what it means. How do people know about this? Is wherever he was, in fact, he started establishing, the Midrashim talk about it, he started establishing academies of prophets, B'nei HaNavim, where they would study to come close to God. And we're going to see later on Vashol HaNavi, that where he goes, there's groups of people who suddenly pop into prophecy because of Shmuel. This is sort of the change of the flow of Hashem. Just coming to a close in terms of thinking about this perek. If we think about this perek, why is this perek necessary now? Meaning, what is this perek adding that we didn't have? If this perek is only about the re-emphasis of a prophecy about Eli's household, then maybe not, right? What is it adding to us? So the most important thing is it's not about so much necessarily the content of that prophecy, but perhaps the fact that it's happening is more important necessarily than the content. Even in the content, though, we saw that Shmuel now does have extra additional content that is beyond Eli. And that's about the news of what's about to happen to the Mishkan itself. And that now sort of shifts Shmuel into a different gear as being a person in a family to a person in a nation, which is what the responsibility there is going to take on. I want to take this opportunity to wish everybody a ksiva v'chasima tova, a year where all of our prayers should be answered to the tova for the good, and God willing, and Metz Hashem, looking forward to continuing with a wonderful year of learning together. Thank you.